What we don't comprehend, what we don't amplify, is the spiritual capital that drives, manifests itself in many of the business relationships that we have today. In fact, what I found across traditions, not just in Christianity, also colors the foundation and the corporate cultures of really outstanding great companies. So there are a lot of examples that one could point to when one thinks of spiritual capital. One is a geopolitical phenomenon. Of course, there was for many centuries something called the slave trade. And it was Wilberforce and his group, the Clapham sect, that put an end to that slave trade. They put an end to the slave trade in Britain and then eventually around the world in North America some decades later, using this kind of spiritual capital that has built up over centuries. And it, in fact, changed the entire business paradigm. Slavery dictated all of the circumstances of business in the 16th, 17th, 18th century. It was changed as a result of the spiritual commitment of those followers. This is a demonstrable fact, and it's very real. Another example, and I've mentioned Max Dupree already, so you know my fondness for this company, Herman Miller, some of you know it, is you know, many, many centuries later, right here on the shores of Lake Michigan, a company grew up around this kind of workplace theology, which is what we've talked about, in the Reformed tradition of values-based leadership, management by persuasion, participation, what he called covenantal relationship, teamwork, shared purpose, dignity, underscore that word, leadership practices, jazz. This is an example of a company, and I'm going to talk a lot about a couple of other companies now that exhibit this kind of spiritual capital. So the question I want to raise for you is, what is the source of your spiritual capital? It's not just a legacy thing. How are you renewing that spiritual capital? How are you bringing that spiritual capital to work? And many of you, I think, are senior leaders or CEOs. You've started many companies or you're involved in other companies on boards as advisors. How are you developing that spiritual capital to sustain those companies over time and into the future? Well, we know what an enterprise is, right? They come in various sizes, shapes, and forms. They are public and private. I've studied mostly large companies, and I serve on the board of four very large publicly traded companies today. But there are also small and medium-sized companies. Some of you are in that space. There are partnerships, proprietorships. They come in every industry, every continent. And I'm going to suggest to you that this spiritual capital can, and in fact must, if you're going to succeed, be present in all of those. That in fact, it is not something that just flavors like a tea bag the color of your water, but it actually transforms those enterprises. When I say that, I mean it affects the mission, it affects the vision, it affects the strategy, and it affects the execution. In other words, it affects all of business in every single facet of management. And this is what we studied for 3 years when we wrote this book, Doing Virtuous Business. Now, I was pleased to find about a year after I'd written my book that other people were coming to the same kind of finding. So to give them credit, my friends at Stanford University, which also has a very good business school, wrote this study, and I recommend the book to you. It's called The Moral Advantage. It's not unlike my book. It's not a quantitative study. It's not a case study book, but it makes this argument that the moral sentiments that one chooses, what I call the spiritual capital that informs not just your reason but your heart, constrains you, as we already heard, from certain kinds of economic activity, precisely from lying, cheating, and stealing. But it also can work on the positive side to create trust. And that trust is what, in fact, makes the market economy possible, the whole generation of wealth. These sentiments, in other words, as Adam Smith himself used the word, place those who possess them in a position to succeed. So this book argues that those companies that followed moral and ethical frameworks were more likely and, in fact, did succeed more than others. And we, frankly, found the very same thing when we studied spiritual capital in our study. Now, this discussion of virtue is a very old one. So if you haven't had a course on the ancients, I can recommend the reading of Plato and Aristotle, because it wouldn't be a bad place to start. And this quotation from Socrates is actually an interesting place. And the point here that I'm underscoring is that virtue is about excellence. For me, the virtues come out of spiritual direction and spiritual maturity. And they are not, in the first instance, about money or about material things or about possession. But quite interestingly, and we had a little lesson on Weber just a minute ago on the Protestant work ethic, they can also lead to a kind of success in public as well as private life. So I divide this list, and I'm going to give you the kind of quick summary findings of my three-year study of 60 companies. When we went out to study the companies, we did a very rigorous kind of look at who we should look at and how we should study them, crunching the numbers. We looked at their 10-Ks. We looked at all those kinds of things that you'd imagine. And then we went out to visit the CEOs and spent a lot of time, frankly, kicking tires. And what we found was quite interesting. No one company exhibited a perfect set of what I call the 14 virtues. But then I don't know a human being, frankly, that possesses those 14 virtues. So they all succeeded on one, two, or three of those virtues. Those were amplified, and they were enculturated in the way they did business. But the best companies, I think, explored more of those virtues. And that's what I'm going to lay out for you. And the challenges I lay out for you is to explore all 14 of these virtues in your personal lives, in your lives as leaders, and in the companies that you work in or that you manage. I divide them into so-called hard and soft virtues, and you'll see why this framework works in a minute. So I'm talking here about what could be called virtue ethics. Now, virtue ethics is different than other forms of ethics. I won't give you that course right now. It's not about what you do. And we heard this as well in one of our earlier presentations. It's about who you are. And if you claim to be a follower of the risen Lord, if you claim to be a Christ follower, then who you are would make a difference in the marketplace. They also constitute a form of happiness, what the Greeks called eudaimonia, an activity in the soul. So this is really soul business. It's not an experience, but a condition. And it helps a person to flourish in a full life. And I think it makes a company a very different kind of company. So practicing these virtues allows you to achieve this kind of condition. Now, the hard virtues are those virtues which we would not identify as being, typically identify as being more masculine in tone. And I don't mean to make this into a kind of gender thing here, but leadership, courage, perseverance, discipline. I mean, most people, even when I give this kind of talk in a secular business school or to a secular audience, say, yeah, business books are written about this. We can do this. You know, if you don't execute, if you're not disciplined, you know, you're not going to succeed in the market. If you don't have the courage, you know, to go to that new place, you're not going to get the job done. So I don't have to make this case. I think it's already been made. But the soft virtues, this is not a case that most business advocates are willing to make. Whether these are more feminine virtues or not, I'll let you decide. Sometimes I get into trouble when I try to suggest to people that these virtues are from Venus and the others are from Mars, but that's a different course. Justice, compassion, forgiveness, gratitude, and I would underscore particularly the last of these, humility. Are these stay-at-home values? The left Marxist critics who I encounter every day in the university say these virtues do not exist in the capitalist system, and that's why they detest capitalism. I'm suggesting that they have a place in a free enterprise capitalism, that the critics are wrong, and there are companies that exhibit these virtues, and they succeed on the basis of these virtues. If you combine the hard and the soft virtues, you have a truly good or great, I would say, virtuous company. If we had that kind of economy, which I favor, we'd have a more virtuous economy. So let me run through the virtues very quickly because we have only so much time. Faith. We start there. Conscience. Obviously, this comes from a Latin definition. It has to do with this allegiance to one's promises in the spiritual sense, the sincerity of intentions, belief and loyalty, the wellspring of purposeful living. So this virtue of faith is found in certain companies, but it's particularly found in companies that are faith-based companies. Now, not all virtuous companies are faith-based companies. Some are faith-friendly, some are a bit agnostic, frankly, but they still strive to be virtuous companies. A company like ServiceMaster, and I'm looking at one example right there, and I think about Bill Pollard every time I read this, because he's been a great supporter of mine over this course and this journey. A company like ServiceMaster, in its service leadership model, really tried to set the example of a faith-based company. Honesty. So most people would say it's best to be an honest company, but how many achieve that? How many actually are straightforward and conduct themselves by the facts, are upright, who actually have a character in action, who see honesty as the heart of commerce, who in fact, don't deceive others, who don't engage in falsehood. I had the opportunity in writing this study to discover a Canadian company, a great company out of the Jewish tradition, who actually built the whole basis of its company around the virtue of honesty. The company is Four Seasons Hotel. Some of you might know Isidore Sharp. Very, very convincing man. Went from nothing as a Jewish immigrant to Toronto to, of course, one of the world's greatest hoteliers, billionaires, philanthropists. But the whole company was built on this Jewish understanding that you treat others the way you want to be treated. Fantastic example. Gratitude means being grateful, evidenced by thankfulness. It's a powerful tool for creating joy, healing, contentment, spiritual growth, and lasting relationships. When you appreciate other people, and great companies appreciate not just their shareholders, but their employees, all of the stakeholders, they actually have this kind of virtue in their DNA. I think of a company like Chick-fil-A. Some of you might know, privately held Baptist-oriented company in North America that actually treats its employees with this kind of gratitude. It gives people who work, and they're mostly young workers, high school age students, a scholarship if they work there a whole year just to show that kind of gratitude. It's a company that embodies this virtue of gratitude very meaningfully. Perseverance, well, I have a little picture here of rowers. My son was the winningest rower in Yale's history. Got up every morning at 5 a.m., rowed for 3 hours, went to class, went back in the afternoon, rowed for 3 hours. You do that for 4 years, you win 3 Ivy League championships and 2 Henley trophies. The perseverance of those amateur rowers was always very, very convincing to me. But there are companies who have turned around, who have persevered, who have been steadfast, who keep asking, as the Bible verse says, keep seeking, keep knocking. This kind of persistence pays off. We talked about risk in the last session, but it's the persevering companies, I think, and there are lots of examples of these, who try and try and try again. Sometimes they're lucky and fortunate. On the fourth try, they actually get there. Compassion is derived, again, from this notion of sympathy, to bear and to suffer. And it's a character trait that balances, I think, the health of societies. Can companies be compassionate? Interesting question. What company comes to mind when I say the virtue of compassion? So I had the good opportunity, you saw them on our little film, and this film is actually a 60-minute PBS documentary that showed to 15 million people, so a lot of people saw it. You saw Muhammad Yunus, who grew up as a Muslim in a very poor part of Bangladesh. And he decided early on that he had to show compassion for the people who had less than him. And he basically invented something called microfinance in Grameen Bank. And it's been, obviously, proliferated around the world in different forms. But it's a way to do what he called social business. It's a way to be compassionate in the workplace. Most of the beneficiaries, by the way, in that scheme have been impoverished women. Forgiveness is not a virtue that most business people want to hear about. Why is that? Well, when you think about what that means, you know, giving up your resentments, being willing to forget and let things go to have that kind of healing effect, that kind of spirit is, frankly, I have found very uncommon in the business place. Now, I worked for a period of time on Wall Street at a notorious firm called Salomon Brothers, which was not very forgiving. In fact, the nicest thing I could say about Salomon Brothers, and Liar's Poker is absolutely accurate, it's a great book, I was there during that tenure, is that we never stabbed anyone in the back because they stabbed everybody in the front. But there are companies, and I found a couple of examples. Tyson Foods, John Tyson, some of you know him, you've worked with him. He actually went through a confessional exercise where he had all kinds of lawsuits against the firm, all kinds of misjudgments, all kinds of difficulties, and he found that by using the spiritual discipline of forgiveness, he could overcome many of those challenges. And today, Tyson's is a much healthier, better firm. It's also a firm, and I point this out, this is for everyone, but employs a large number of chaplains, workforce chaplains, to help them do their business and actually to conduct this kind of forgiveness. Patience is not unlike perseverance. My wife says this is the virtue I lack, so I can probably not talk about it at any great length. But when you think about those kinds of business leaders who have been calm, who have been steadfast, even in adversity, who focus on and can actually change things and have that kind of process notion of getting there over a period of time, it's quite interesting. And we found a number of companies that actually evidence this kind of patience. Humility, as I said, again, is very difficult to find in the business place. But as we were told in an earlier session, humility is also the first virtue in spiritual life. I think that any business that's not accompanied by humility is eventually destroyed by conceit, by narcissism. So pray that you will have humility, and then that can be structured into the very organizational behaviors of your firm. Because the tone at the top matters, believe me. We just finished doing a CEO report at Oxford. We interviewed 150 global CEOs last year, and we found a number of interesting changes around the whole notion of leadership. One of them is that leaders not only want to be more authentic, as we heard, but they're struggling to be more humble. Difficult, but necessary. Facing the challenges of the current economy demands that kind of humility. Courage is obviously seen sometimes as a strength, mental and moral, sometimes military, the ability to withstand danger and difficulty, to progress. And occasionally, companies are very courageous. A company that we studied at length and a company that I admire a great deal is a company that makes more diesel engines than any company in the world. It's Cummins, based in Indiana, based in the spirit of Methodism, of Wesley's rule. And that company was the first company to leave South Africa during the realm of apartheid. It had the courage to walk away from a business. Well, we discovered in studying Cummins, which has a lot of other examples that they don't brag about, it was also a company that funded Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement from day one. It had courage to do things that companies were not always expected to do. Respect is an important virtue. The companies that respect the environment, that respect their employees, I think have an advantage. And this means that they have a deference, they have an esteem, They recognize the inherent worth of people. They treat people with dignity and honor. And today, of course, in organizational behavior, we talk about flatter organizations. We talk about the diminution of hierarchy. So respect is more important than ever. And how you treat the people you work with, and how you treat your customers, and how you treat those others you engage with, I think leads to either a great deal of admiration or a great deal of affection, and that is a value that is very important in today's economy. So Herman Miller, who I've already mentioned, came out as one of the most admired companies on the Fortune 500 most admired list the first time it was issued. They've never left that list. They have this culture of human respect. Generosity is characterized by a noble, forbearing spirit, this kind of heart, this kind of liberality in giving. I think it's one of the best ways to show love and friendship. Companies can be generous. They can be generous in the foundational support, the philanthropic acts that they have, or the way they give back in responsible leadership. And discipline, the final virtue, of course, is this notion that perfects the mental faculties. I would say also the moral character through control gained by obedience. Wesley's rule might be something to quote here. I found that Walmart was a company, interestingly, that did this better than any other company that we studied. So what I'm talking about here, and I'm really setting up our next speaker, is servant leadership. These 14 virtues, when put together, amount to something that Greenleaf in the 1960s called servant leadership. And this is what we're called to do, a matter of character, not of goals, and the greatest fund of support for servant leadership is faith. So I want to leave you with, I'm a business school professor, a little two-by-two, right? Got to have a two-by-two. When you think about power on one axis and service on the other axis, I want to challenge you in your journeys as Christian leaders. Obviously, you'll become more competent. You went to B school. You've been trained in the market. You get more authority. You go up on that axis on the left-hand side. You get a lot of power. It can go to your head. The question is, what do you do when you have a crucible of power? What kind of trajectory is that? And the question that I really want to raise for you is, when and how, and do you have that redemptive turn? Do you descend as a leader in a realignment through some test of humility? I think by emptying yourself in grace into wisdom. And if you can do that, then you will practice a kind of wisdom that is mature in the marketplace and that will embody itself not only in acts of power, but precisely in acts of service. And this is the journey that I think we're called to. I think there's a cycle around this. I've written about this: producing wealth, generating wealth, saving some of that wealth, being generous with a great deal of that work. I think that God called us into being for self-donation, to give to others. That's the purpose for our being on this planet. And with that, part of that is renewing our culture, also our business culture. So I've written a book as well about bad companies, in case you're interested in those. And there are a heck of a lot of bad companies. Why so many bad companies at this turn in capitalism? It's a question that plagues me, and this very scary book documents who and how and why they came into being. It's a bookend book, frankly, to the book on virtuous companies. Why are there so many companies today that take that other path, whose leaders have nothing to do with virtue? I've also this new little book on practical wisdom, which is case studies. Rick said, of course, we need more case studies to teach students and obviously to bring people into a kind of questioning attitude about how you build those cultures. So you need textbooks to do that. And that's the end. Thank you.
Thank you for putting so much in such a short moment. There's a lot of fascinating things in your CV, including you were the guy who really oversaw the rule writing, I understand, for global paperless trading. So you really understand the ethics crisis that happened around 2008. What are we still waiting to address in that? The ethics challenges of 2008. What do we still need to build in virtue into the global economy? And that's a question from the floor.
So I this is on. I think we nearly fell into the abyss in 2008. And I get this question often, have we learned anything as a result? Because we really did come close to the end of capitalism as we know it. And the answer is we have learned very little because we're repeating ourselves all over again. And at the end of this book, which is a very depressing book on the end of ethics, I was writing this book, and every time I finished the book and Wiley published it, they said, well, you didn't write a chapter about MF Global. It just happened. Oh, you didn't write a chapter about LIBOR. It just happened. You didn't write a chapter about fill in the blank. I just wrote an op-ed last week about Volkswagen. It continues. And the reason we have not, I would say, is because it's a three-leg stool. It has, in the first instance, to do with taking personal responsibility. That would mean that you have to have a spiritual character. You have to have a backbone. It means, secondly, you have to form in the organizations that we have, the businesses, particularly the large businesses, a corporate culture that is ethical, that has to do with these virtues. And thirdly, and I don't start there, it also has to do with a governmental system and a regulatory system that ensures that people who do the wrong things not only get caught, but pay the penalty. And there have been too few penalties paid.
You referenced a foundation to all of this in the beginning of your talk when you spoke about half of the MBAs in your class did not know what the word virtue meant. Most of us in this room have a leadership connection to our churches. What would you advise we do as Christian leaders in the Christian story and teaching do in this kind of secular climate?
Well, the reason I say that, and I was referring to Yale, but I could also refer to my present employer, Oxford, is that most of these students do not have a religious orientation. So while they may have, in some past life, been attached to, you know, some grandmotherly virtue, or have had the Bible read on their knee or the Quran, they've more or less jettisoned those traditions and are not living in them. So they are not atheists in any strict sense, but they are in the category of what we call none, and that's not N-U-N, but N-O-N-E. They don't have any biblical literacy. They don't have any religious tradition. They have not read the great books. They do not know the Bible. So for those of us who are still involved in churches or in lay ministries or in Youth for Christ or in any other kind of institution, I think we have to underscore, first of all, the reading of the Bible again, and we have to teach those stories that so many of us have benefited from because the culture doesn't know those stories or those words any longer.
There's a really transparent part in your book on being generous, which I want to quote from. And you write about you yourself took a journey from narcissism to compassion, and that you have always found it very hard to give away your money, to be a generous person. Talk to us about how God transformed that in you.
Well, I think that many of us who grew up in North American culture, which is a materialist culture, who are achievement-oriented, who have done well, frankly, you know, have run things, who have made a good living, who have gotten large bonuses, have felt like we earned it. You know, it's ours to do with what we want, to invest how we want, and to buy the things we want. And while I knew in my own spiritual tradition that wasn't the case, I had to relearn it. It's interesting, the place that I learned it was the floor of Solomon Brothers. And I'll tell you the story if you have 30 seconds. You get a very large bonus on Wall Street, of course, for your performance. And at the end of the year, of course, those bonuses are giving out, and people are very happy. I got a very large bonus. and I made the mistake of telling people that I was going to give more than half of it away to certain organizations that I had been involved in, and I was the laughing stock of the floor at Salomon Brothers. And it actually became clear to me in that one instance, in that one day, that that culture was not a place that I could survive. So it was transformative. I actually believe that God gives us all of our talents, all of our treasure, and he expects it to actually be stewarded and given back to him.
Which brings us back to the challenge you gave us all when you started your talk, and that is, how are you fueling your spiritual self? Ted, how do you do that? What's your discipline?
I would say two things. One is through a life of devotion. And I don't want to recommend any, you know, one set of devotion. I think that's a highly personal thing. It involves prayer. It involves reading. It involves reflection. It revolves, critical thinking. And a life of fellowship. So that fellowship could take part, you know, in a spiritual community. It could take part in a church. It could take part in a different organization. I have personally been bonded to 8 other men for about 35 years, and we keep each other accountable.
How often do you talk?
When I lived in Washington, D.C., we talked every Thursday morning for breakfast, and it's the thing I miss most because I haven't been in Washington, D.C. for a number of years.
But you continue that friendship with those 8 guys, and have all your careers been the same, or is there a lot of diversity?
Well, Washington is a very political place, so a number of these people were very prominent in the political apparatus. A couple of them were in business. One was the ambassador of a certain country. So people who had, distinguished careers, but who could keep each other accountable on the basis of their faith commitment.
Give us your advice on mentoring. Who do you choose to mentor? How much time do you invest in that?
So I do believe in mentoring, and I have been mentored. I've had great teachers. I was reminded by somebody in this room today about one of my mentors in Toronto, who was a great, great spiritual thinker, philosopher. I mentor a number of students, so I have advisees, obviously, and I have many more people knocking on my door than I can possibly talk to. But I think that we do have to, particularly those of us who have succeeded in the world of business or in the world of commerce, open ourselves up to helping the next generation. I do that as well by speaking and by writing books and by having conversations.
All right. Mr. Malik, everyone, thank you very much, sir. Dr. Malik.